Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast. To search for other podcasts you might like, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
So now we're going to hear the fascinating story of a young Scotsman who became instrumental in the development of cricket here in South Africa. James Douglas Logan was the son of a Borders railway man who emigrated to South Africa at the age of 19 in 1877. He made his fortune through business and politics, but also became associated with cricket. He was an untalented player himself, but saw the power of cricket within what was a colonial society and became instrumental in arranging some of the first ever international matches between England and South Africa, and played a key role in developing the career of one of the greats of the game. And Logan once managed to have the captain and the manager of the England team arrested. Well, his story is told in a new book, Empire, War and Cricket in South Africa, written by Dean Allen, a sports historian at Bournemouth University. He was also taught at top universities here in South Africa. Welcome,
Jonathan,
Dean.
Thank you for having me. What a pleasure.
It's a meaty tome.
It is indeed, yeah. It's a book I'm really proud of. It took 10 years to write, really. I mean, it came from a PhD, but took 5 years, and then to turn it into a book, yes, took another five.
See, I am fascinated by the origins of cricket, actually, around the world. Clearly, on the back of the empire, as it was. I mean, be it in India, Sri Lanka, Pakistan, West Indies, through the Caribbean, and so on. And the legacy of what we took and what we've left behind has not always been a happy ending, has it? Frankly, from what the empire has done. I wonder what your interest really has been in writing this.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's the title, Empire, War and Cricket. It was how this whole thing sort of came about. I mean, I moved to South Africa in the mid-90s, so I was sort of foot in both camps. And, I mean, such a wonderful country in terms of its history. And with the recent politics, of course, the archives have opened up. So I was here at a time where history was kind of being rewritten, and characters like James Logan had been missed. So for me, yes, he's one of those characters that history has missed. The fact he's a Scotsman, the fact that he arrived at that time, just when diamonds, of course, had been discovered. He's a big friend of Cecil Rhodes, and we know that Rhodes, again, is in the news at the moment. So that's an interesting side to this story. But for me, the fascination with this is the fact how cricket, as you know, was brought around the British Empire, yes, by, for various means. And I talk about Logan, what his inspiration was. It was not always for empire and for queen and country, as it were. It was for his own empire.
Yes, and it was sort of the facade, wasn't it, that was put on on taking cricket around. This is how it's a gentleman's game.
Yes.
And this is how we shall teach our servants how to play and everything else. And it was for what was supposed to be great and good about the Brits.
Very much so.
But in fact, it wasn't always the case.
No, very much so. I mean, to be considered a sportsman, you would not consider your motives, and of course to be involved in this wonderful game of cricket at that time, and with cricket having reached other parts of the world, it was a little later to get here to South Africa. Of course, Major Wharton's team came down in 1889, the first ever tour. By that stage, my man Logan had arrived. He'd made his money and he saw the power of the game, so he wanted to get involved in the next subsequent tour, which was in 1891. And you talk about this wonderful story about the English team getting arrested, or the manager and the captain. Logan was responsible for that because he was a benefactor, Jonathan. What you needed to bring the England teams down here was someone who was going to put the money up.
Yes.
And what Logan did was sponsor that tour in 1891. And the agreement was that he would get his money back with interest. This was the days, of course, of amateurism. We know about Grace,
sure,
etc.
Yep.
And for them to come down here, they needed someone to put the funds up. And that's what Logan did. So during my research, I found this wonderful correspondence between Logan and the captain and the manager talking about this agreement. It was all very kind of shadily worded. But of course, in 1891, they expected the crowds to come out and flock to see the England team, and it wasn't the success that they'd all hoped. So the English thought they were going to slip away on the ship, but Logan had other ideas. He had them arrested at Cape Town docks. Got a wonderful.
Why? What for? What?
Because they hadn't paid his money back with interest. In other words, he wanted to make money out of this.
Yes.
But he became a darling of certainly the Cape press down here, because he was taking on the establishment. And wonderful account in the book is a scorecard. He actually took them to court, and the scorecard reads, Gentleman of England 0, South Africa, J.D. Logan, 857, not out, innings declared closed. Of course, he took them for £857.
Wow, a lot of money.
It was big money, yeah.
So how did it start? This 19-year-old then, the son of a railway worker up in Scotland, I mean, What prompted to get on a ship and come down to Cape Town?
Well, it was the height of the British Empire. I mean, as an ambitious working class guy, I mean, perhaps he saw his, well, certainly opportunity was greater elsewhere. Ironically,
he was by himself, did he? Left his family behind.
Very much so. Yeah, very much so. As a 19-year-old. I mean, he was actually on his way to Australia. That's what makes this story even more incredible. I mean, between London and the Cape, of course, the ship was going to stop up in the Cape as it went round. He's clearly had a conversation with a few people, and they said, "Well, hang on a minute, you're a railwayman." He had that experience. He'd worked with his father up in the borders of Scotland, and Cape Town Station had just been completed. They were trying to build the railway, as Rhodes said. It was the key to the continent, the railway.
And he had all the way up.
Very much so.
Yeah.
And diamonds had just been discovered in Kimberley. So can you imagine this incredible wealth? And this place became the Wild West for those people with the ambition and probably, you know, the strength of character, and he was a true entrepreneur. He got off that ship and he never made it to Australia, of course, and this is where he made his home. And by the age of 25, he'd become a millionaire in today's terms, and he built his own town, which I talk about in the book, a funny little place called Mikeysfontein, which exists today. It's a part of South Africa's folklore, and that's why this book has done extremely well here in South Africa, because nobody ever written a story behind this quirky Victorian town that exists 2.5 hours outside of Cape Town. It's a Victorian village, perfectly preserved, and James Logan built that. So now he's promoting the cricket. He's built a town in the middle of the semi-desert. He's creating things where no one else had created anything. Who would question his motives or how he earned his money?
No, indeed.
Very clever man.
So, I mean, how did he make that money? I mean, what happened? What happened between him landing in Cape Town and building the town? Well, how did it all happen?
Well, he was appointed as porter at the new Cape Town station, and within a matter of months, he's the Cape Town station master. So, I mean, he's clearly got some kind of ability and charisma. The railways were the key to his success. Soon he was given the job of district superintendent in the Karoo region. Can you imagine the railways now being built up into the interior to try and reach the diamond fields?
Rough too, desert.
Very much so. James Logan had you know, it was clearly he networked and whatever. A lovely story in the book, by the way. This job mustn't go to a single man, so not a problem for our charismatic Scot. He married someone within 3 months. Well-connected hotelier's daughter who was in with local politicians and the newspaper men. So that was quite
nice. I like this man yet.
I don't know if people do like him, and I don't know if I do, but I certainly admire him in many respects. But the wonderful thing how he used the railways, of course. If you controlled the railways and the railway station in particular, you had influence on the local community. And that's what he did. He bought into the refreshment room business. So if you can imagine in those days, when a train goes through the station, there was no catering facilities on the actual train itself. So you're a captive market. People had to get off, pay the exorbitant prices at the station, eat their meal and get back on. Logan at one point controlled over 20 stations right up through to Rhodesia, Zimbabwe, as it is now. Another incredible tale in the book. By now he's politically active, and he's very much closely aligned to Rhodes and his politics. A friend of his, a fellow Scotsman in Rhodes' government, awarded James Logan the monopoly of all railway refreshment facilities for 20 years. Can you imagine it? Can you imagine what that was going to bring in? The more liberal members of Rhodes' government actually said, no, enough of this. This money politics has gone on too long. Rhodes was called back from England where he was on holiday. Rhodes couldn't really see the fuss, what it was all about, which was wonderful. He was forced to actually disband his own government. So Logan brought down Rhodes' first government. And so now I can see this incredible story that cricket is a central theme, but there's so much more going on.
Yes, well, let's introduce the politics here, because back in, so here we're one, 18, where are we, 70s, 80s now?
Yeah, yeah, 1870s, 80s.
So politically in Cape Town, you've got obviously the settling Brits, you've got the Dutch, you've got the Africans, you've got Asians.
Yep.
So already there's a sort of hotbed of, I mean, was there this sort of racial issue that developed under the form of apartheid then? What was it like in Cape Town in those days?
Well, it was very multicultural as it is today, a fantastic city as we all know. But when Logan arrived in the late 1870s, it was very much a colonial town. Well, the British ruled. I mean, the Great Trek, the Afrikaners had left the Cape and settled up further in the north in the mid 1800s. So there was this tension always between certainly the Europeans, the English speakers, and the Afrikaners.
Yes.
And then of course you've got this wonderful mix of Africans and, as I said, the Cape Malay population. big sports players as well. Yes. All these wonderful histories are coming out now that have not been written. It's not just the English who are playing cricket at this time, of course. The whole population down there were playing. The language is different, of course, Jonathan. If you look in the book how people are referred to, I mean, there was very much a hierarchy, of course, but people lived and worked alongside each other.
There's more tolerance.
I wouldn't say tolerance. There was certainly, people knew their place, as it were. I mean, apartheid was the evil that was going to be introduced later on in the 1900s. That was a different dynamic. But if you look at James Logan, for example, I mean, the way he refers to, I mean, the Crom Hendricks story, for example. In 1894, the first ever South African tour leaves the shores to go to England. It was politically motivated. James Logan wanted to control that tour, but he fell out with his mate Cecil Rhodes, who ultimately had the final say because of the selection of a colour player called Crom Hendricks, who the English batsman has said was one of the finest bowlers they'd ever faced in the practice nets. That's the point. In the practice nets, he'd never played first-class cricket.
But even back then, there was a segregation.
Very much so. Rhodes later says to Pelham Warner, the future English captain, "My hands were tied in 1894. I understood the need to take a player of ability." But I could not have a player of colour representing South Africa. And he actually referred to, interestingly enough, he said about the Aboriginal tour that left Australia. Yes. He said because the English would have them throwing boomerangs during the lunch interval. So there's some real serious issues here as well to flush out. I mean,
so where did the cricket start in Mikey's Fontein? Have you guys excuse my apology, my pronunciation was probably terrible. I struggled with some Yorkshire names yesterday. Was that okay? Is it Matty's Fontein?
It's called Mikey's Fontein, which is the irony, of course, this wonderful imperial colonial place, and it did exist, by the way. It was like a railway siding when Logan, he bought up the land because it was cheap there. The railway went
right to it. That looks like a very Afrikaans name to me.
Yes, exactly. So that gives its heritage. And someone suggested that our famous Scotsman change it to Logansville, which he turned round and with his typical modesty said, "It's not that I've done so much in the area, others have done so little," which was fantastic.
So this very wealthy man has got there. He's established this town. Yeah. And now when does he start, therefore, getting the cricket influence into this and developing cricket in this part of the world?
Well, as early as I said, he saw the influence of the first English team. Now, when the English toured, when they arrived, can you imagine the excitement? The biggest sports team in the world, which is the England cricket team.
On his invitation, or on the guarantee that he was going to pay the English team so much
Wharton
money.
Came down in 1889, and then, of course, the next team, Reed's team, came in 1891, and he stepped forward with the money.
Right, because he could see socially it was a good thing to do, business-wise.
Very much so. Okay. Who would question his motives? Like we see today, anyone who puts money into sport, it's seen as it's altruistic, as it were. Yes. But with James Logan, he saw the bigger picture. His ambition was to take a team back to the United Kingdom. That was his big ambition. He could really influence things. And remember, of course, he's a working class Scot. He was new money. So it was a case of buying social elevation. How would he get those invitations to Ascot and Lords when he went back? And he did that by influencing the game. And of course, as I write about, various people were helping him in that. George Lohmann, the Surrey and England...
One of the greats.
Yes. One of the greats. I mean, George Lohmann arrived through ill health. He was going to spend the winter in South Africa, sent down here by Surrey. James Logan met him as he got off the ship at Cape Town and said, "My dear boy, you're coming with me to my health resort at Mikey's Fontein." And there he had his ally, because Logan then had, with Lohmann by his side, he had those connections. And of course, later on in the 1890s, Lord Hawke, that aristocratic Yorkshireman, of course.
One of Geoffrey's friends.
Of course. Yeah, I was speaking to Mr. Boycott yesterday about it.
Don't talk about Lord Hawke with a breeze that sets him off.
No, of course.
But he came over too. Right.
So
these matches then are funded, and they presumably toured around South Africa as a whole, but did they always play a game? I mean, there was a pitch, a field at the Mikey's Fontein, and it was all a big social event, presumably.
Logan spent thousands of pounds in 1894 building a first-class cricket pitch. Within the book, you've got these wonderful images of the cream of world cricket. Ferris, those kind of people, C.B. Fry, playing at this place in the semi-desert. You can still see the boundary there today. We recreated a cricket pitch recently. Griff Rhys-Jones was down there for the Slow Train Through Africa, for example, the ITV programme, and we set up a game, and people are just fascinated by the context in which this was played. And of course, you've got to remember, the teams, not like today, fly around the country. They were on the train, so they always travelled through Mikey's Fontein. They stopped and played for a few days. Logan was in the British press, the Empire press, throughout the world. You know, he was written about in Australia as this man who would put on these wonderful games. 1899 and 1895, the two tours that Hawke came down, Logan was actually seated alongside Hawke in the official team photo. That's how important he was. But the timing was out, of course, by now, because the politics got back.
Right, well, here we go. So I was going to ask about this. So the question now of the Europeans, the Brits who are playing cricket, the Afrikaners, I noted that in the first test match played by South Africa, there were two Afrikaners actually playing in that.
Yeah.
So there was a certain integration was there, or at least there were some Afrikaners who at least had some interest in cricket. But then what happens when war breaks out? I mean, this is extraordinary.
It's far too simplistic to say that cricket was the game for the English. I mean, it was political tensions and the control of the game that generally moved towards the English-speaking population that meant that it was selected in such a way. 1895 Hawke's down here, the Jameson raid. This is where Rhodes and his allies tried to stir up trouble in the north because of the goldfields. Kruger was sitting on the biggest mineral find in world history, and something had to happen. The funny story about that is Hawke actually invited Kruger to a game in Johannesburg, which the president respectfully declined. No surprise there, but cricket solves everything.
Yeah.
But in 1899, these tensions came to a head, of course, when the South African War, the Anglo-Boer War, as it's widely known, broke out. And Hawke had just been touring before that. And the whole political landscape changed. So if we look at how cricket developed beyond the war, I know we'll talk more about that now, but cricket really got an English identity in this country. And the Afrikaners then took rugby as their game. And I've written a bit about that, you know, beating them at their own game, where the Afrikaners turned rugby into, you know, certainly the Springbok symbol into their game, whereas cricket, you know, at the top level, yes, remained very English. And war did that, of course. It was a bitter civil war. It split families, not just different groups. Everybody suffered in that war. I mean, more Africans were killed than the whites in a so-called white man's war, so...
And yet, they toured during the war in 1901. Logan manages to get a tour to the UK, first class for the first time, the matches that were played, managed by George Logan, obviously conveniently. But how on earth did even this man, who seems to have manipulated an awful lot of situations and deals to suit himself, but even this seems miraculous, to take a South African team to England when they're at war? It seems unbelievable.
It's what inspired this story, Jonathan. I mean, can you believe it?
Imagine playing football against the Germans in 1944.
Of course. I mean, the Springboks in 1906, the first ever team, contained a team that had Afrikaners, the Springbok rugby team, Afrikaners and English, and that was seen as a tour of reconciliation. But this was even more incredible. James Logan used the fact that the South African Cricket Association had disbanded during the war, and he got his ambition together. Basically, he got a very, very talented team together, mainly Cape Colony team. And he, with his friend Hawke, he got a first-class tour arranged, and they left in April 1901. The war is still raging, and they're known as Logan's Team, and they arrive right in the midst of a real bitter phase of the war, the guerrilla phase of the war.
And it was horrible.
It was horrible,
yeah.
Kitchener was down here, scorched earth. I mean, it's...
Yes. Truly shocking stuff.
No, very much so. I mean, there isn't a blockbuster movie to be made out of this story because it's got everything, you know. But Logan arrives, of course, in 1901, and Arthur Conan Doyle, no less, that great imperialist, the creator of Sherlock Holmes, writes in the press, how dare this South African team arrive when they should be fighting a war back in their own country? Now, Logan, of course, this is bad press for him, he arrives.
Yes.
He points out the fact... In a reply within the Spectator newspaper, he points out that the colours of the South African team are the South African War Medal. Himself has had his horse shot from underneath him in a battle, which is a load of nonsense, by the way. I've disproved that. And most of his team have served. Some had, of course. But within weeks, he was a darling of the British press. They go on to play these first-class matches, the MCC, the Oxford, Cambridge University, the main counties. There's a wonderful picture of Logan's team with W.G. Grace's London County at the Crystal Palace.
Surely.
And he's doing this in the middle of the war.
What was this team called? Was it called South Africa?
It was called the South Africans, South Africa. They're officially the second South African team to go away. They didn't play a test against England. I think that would be pushing his luck. But if Hawke could have got his way, perhaps they would have done. But they're officially the second ever team. So they're known as the Colonials, Logan's Team, South Africans. And he did that. And an interesting, lovely story. He actually selected his own son, Jimmy Jr., who only played first-class cricket once in his life, and that was for South Africa.
I mean, that element is particularly extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, just to sink it and think of how that could possibly happen these days.
Yeah.
I don't know. But whether it's the... the scale of the media or something, or whether there was a naivety back in England. I don't know. I'm guessing as to how on earth that was able to happen.
We were talking earlier, this man actually understood the power of the media, and the media there, of course, was not radio or TV. It was the written word. And it was hard doing this research for the PhD and now the book to find any bad news about this guy. But there was, of course, and he made a lot of enemies. And he's a political animal. Yeah, there was a lot of, you know, there's another side to this story. But James Logan understood the power of the press. So it was 80% positive. He controlled his own newspaper, by the way, in the Worcester region where he was from. So a lot of news came out. And he was known as the ideal colonial. That's what he was called, you know, man of his time. And of course, the story is almost complete when he was invited back in 1902 to the coronation of Edward VII. So we have this working-class Scot who arrives penniless at the age of 19, who then is now mixing with nobility and royalty through this wonderful game of cricket. Who would question his motives? Yeah. And that's the fascination for it.
What's his legacy now? If you fast-forward, you know, 100 years and look at the South African cricket now, and the way it was set up from those early days. I mean, was he involved in setting up of the various associations? And of course, the politics has obviously torn sport apart here as well. What would remain of what he set up all those years ago?
I tell you what has remained, which is really interesting, is the Logan Cup in Zimbabwe.
Of course it has, yes, indeed.
And that's why this book has got so much resonance elsewhere as well. Robin Jackman sat in at one of my talks recently, and of course Robin had played, and he said, I've played in that tournament so many times, and I didn't know where it came from. James Logan, of course, saw the power of publicity. Sir Donald Currie had given quite a famous cup, the Currie Cup, some years earlier. And of course, on the back of Hawke's tour, they went up to Zimbabwe, Rhodesia at the time, Zimbabwe now, for the first time. Logan was in the train with them, and he had a big silver trophy made, and they still play for that today. So that's a wonderful legacy. That's their premier domestic trophy. But apart from that, what he did is he set up, I think, in a difficult time, he kept this game alive. He certainly promoted it. But he also knew when to withdraw. He was very good at getting into things. So he withdrew from politics permanently in 1908 because the Union of South Africa was to come around in 1910. And he handed over the mantle to a chap called Sir A. Bailey. Now, you'll know Sir A. Bailey was instrumental in the Imperial Cricket Conference, of course, and he saw the wider vision. I've always said that it was about James Logan's empire, but as a benefactor on the ground, he certainly had incredible influence.
Well, I've got to go to Marcus Fontaine, haven't I? I don't know when I'll get the chance to, but it sounds like a very good read. I mean, where is it can I jump in a car at Cape Town and drive up?
Yeah, it's about 2 hours outside of Cape Town, on the N1, straight up to Johannesburg. And for cricket fans, I mean, there's so much there. I mean, George Lohmann is buried there. Yes. Wonderful, wonderful monument to George Lohmann, and obviously with the war.
Because he came back again, didn't he? And TV having nailed him.
Consumption, as they called it then. He came back, and he actually died shortly after Logan's tour. So he was there as a manager to see at the age of 36, which is incredible. So he's buried at Mikey's Fontaine. But it's, as I said, it's one of these quirky places that until now, people don't really know its significance. And it's perfectly preserved. If Logan had achieved what he did back in the old country, back in England, dozens of books would have been written about him, perhaps even a film. But the fact it was here and its location, and that's how he achieved what he did, of course.
What an extraordinary man. What a lovely story. Dean, thank you very much indeed for coming and sharing that with us. Empire, War and Cricket in South Africa is the title of the book.
On digital and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
bbc.co.uk/5live.